Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hi. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the oversized AirPods charging case that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the psychological traps of freelancing, Instagram anxiety for artists, and graphic design as performance. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest duo, Tin and Ed. As well as being two of our favorite people, Tin and Ed are creative directors and artists working between New York and Melbourne. Through installations and live digital experiences, Tin and Ed seek to explore the convergence of our physical and digital worlds. Not only have they worked with a very enviable list of clients, including Nike, Adidas, IKEA, and Visa, just to name some, they've also exhibited and lectured throughout the world, recently speaking at Design Indaba, the AGI Congress in Mexico City, and Hong Kong Design Week. Their work has been shown at the Sydney Opera House, the National Gallery of Victoria here in Melbourne, and the Lu Haisu Art Museum in Shanghai. Joining us all the way from New York, Tin and Ed, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. Hello.
Good. Hello.
We're good. Thank you.
I'm very excited to be on the podcast.
Yes,
very
same.
Exciting. We're so excited to have you. And as I always say, like, it's always my favorite when someone listens to the show and also just happens to be, like, you know, my favorite person and then can join us properly. And we saw you not even that long ago here in Melbourne, but you're back in New York now.
It's weird to be on the podcast because I've listened to so many of the episodes. So it's quite surreal, actually.
It's complete circle.
Yeah.
Jeremy, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Again, I'm so happy to have Tin and Ed here. I mean, I didn't mention this in the bio, but, you know, Tin and Ed are actually one of the first 12 Jackie Winter artists, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's a hallmark occasion. Since then, we've gone our separate ways professionally, but, you know, you've kind of expanded and developed your practice in kind of new and exciting ways. And yeah, it's been amazing to kind of watch, you know, from our perspective, how you guys have done. So yeah, I'm so excited to have you back here.
Right. Thank you.
Well, I think we're just going to get stuck straight into it. Laura, your first link this week, take us away.
This is an article from The Cut, which is New York Magazine's women's vertical. It's one of my favorite publications at the moment.
What's a vertical?
A vertical? A vertical is like a very specific title dedicated to one area of an industry.
It's not a skate ramp.
Jeremy, stop pretending to be cool. Oh, my God.
Keep going.
I'm a cool dad. It's written by financial advice columnist Charlotte Cowles for her My Two Cents column, and it's titled The Psychological Trap of Freelancing. And basically, it just outlines this sort of key anxiety that I imagine is common for many, if not all, freelancers, which is the way that kind of all of your time becomes inextricably linked to income and the guilt and frustration that can come with that. So just to read from the piece first, she begins, "For most of my career, I was paid a salary. It was not very much, especially at the beginning, but it also seemed to exist on a different plane from my actual job. I worked as hard and as much as I could, and then twice a month, a dollar amount materialized in my checking account. My time did not feel tethered to this money. My paycheck was just a byproduct of going into an office every day, and a pretty arbitrary one at that. But once I started freelancing, things changed. I became hyper-conscious of how much money I could or should charge for my time, and this made me unhappy and mean when my non-working hours didn't measure up to the same value. It was akin to the rage of watching cab fare tick up while you're sitting in traffic, minutes and dollars dribbling away before your eyes. A freelancer friend recently commiserated, 'I went outside to get coffee and ran into three different neighbors who wanted to chit chat. I wanted to scream, for every word that comes out of your mouth, I'm losing money.'" And so she goes on to talk about how this kind of, you know, it did force her to get a bit better at managing her finances and become comfortable with asking for bigger fees. But she was also super stressed out. Like, she was sleeping less. She wasn't socializing as much anymore. And she would sometimes feel kind of pretty extreme guilt for spending, you know, a Sunday watching telly in bed instead of working. And as she highlights in the article, you know, recent research out of Harvard and Columbia shows that people who attach dollar signs to their time or, you know, value time like money tend to be overwhelmingly less happy than those who don't, because their non-working hours suddenly seem less important and free time gets sort of tainted with guilt because there is a cost associated with it now. And studies show that many, you know, Americans, and I imagine people all over the world too, fall into this exact trap. And these studies, it's worth noting, also accounted for factors like income, because, you know, my initial thoughts and the writer also mentions was that, yeah, like, of course, prioritizing time over money is a luxury that only rich people can afford. But it seems based on these studies that it isn't actually even tied to how much you make, but rather just that your income is tied to billable hours versus like a salary. And as the world moves further and further away from salaried jobs and towards these sort of short-term contract gigs, you know, we're always talking about the gig economy, this problem is sort of likely to become more widespread. So if valuing money over time is making us sad and guilty and paranoid, how do we stop that? So the article suggests that it lies in like changing your approach to time off, that, you know, maybe it's not possible to decouple time and money in our brains, especially if finances are a bit tight, but perhaps we can sort of lean into that. The article quotes this psychologist, Ashley Willens, who is a professor at the Harvard Business School, who actually researches time poverty. And she says, if we're already in the time is money mindset, we can reframe our leisure time as something that enables us to be more productive in the future. When we're conditioned to think of all our time as on the clock, leisure time feels abstract and unsatisfying. But if we tell ourselves that leisure time is another means to achieve that goal or financial outcome, that can make us more likely to take the breaks that we need, enjoy them fully, and be happier in general. And I think this is true, of course. You know, we can only do our best work if we're taking good care of our brains and our bodies, and that requires definite downtime. But I do kind of hate this idea as well that, you know, it still needs to be tied to productivity, that like the only reason to relax is to make you more productive later rather than, you know, relaxing, enjoying your life for the sake of it. And then the other trick that Charlotte offers up is to figure out what you're willing and can afford to outsource and what you'd prefer to do yourself. So maybe it's like paying someone to do your laundry or you get food delivered. But, you know, here, of course, is where income makes a very significant difference. Not everyone can afford the luxury of ordering out so that they can finish another draft of a freelance project. So anyway, I want to dive into this a bit further with you guys. I mean, all of us here, I believe, Jeremy, you as well, have worked freelance at some point in our lives. Tin and Ed, for you, much of your lives. I want to know, did anything in this article resonate with you? Let's start with you guys.
I think what you sort of said at the end resonated with us the most, which is that in terms of this idea of this connection of time and money, let's maybe we'll start with that we don't really consider ourselves freelancers. I think there was a shift in the thinking that we had a little while ago, and it's a very, you know, small sort of shift. Well, it was a big shift, but we sort of are freelancers, but we are also sort of running a business, I guess. And there was a shift a little while ago where we realized that actually we were running a business, and we're self-employed. So there's the same sort of thing applies where we don't have a sort of regular sort of income, and we're always having to sort of think about where, you know, we have to think about where the next sort of project is going to come in and manage our money in such a way that allows us to sort of do what we want.
You don't get paid regardless of what you do, you know, like for people with a regular full-time job. You can sort of go in and do your thing, leave knowing you will get paid.
And I think that we started sort of we do time tracking. That sort of definitely helps us sort of figure out how much time we should be spending on things. But I think naturally...
I think on that note, actually sort of understanding time was really important for us. So literally to be, you know, doing things like time tracking was something I literally never thought I would ever do. But my dad is an architect, and he suggested that maybe I kind of give that a go, because I think like every single architect does that. And it was really interesting, because it's like you're like, oh, I actually am spending quite a lot of time on doing something like that. So that really helps you to kind of understand, like, yeah, do you need to outsource that?
Like you realize you're actually losing money by doing work. That sort of happened a lot. So it made us more aware of time. But I think that naturally we don't really go, oh, shit, we're just losing money right now, you know, when we're, you know, lying in bed watching, you know, Netflix. But part of it too is for us, you know, the decisions that we've made have always been really creative sort of decisions. And when we sort of learnt that actually to make smart business decisions as well helped us to be more creative. Like that's sort of when the shift sort of came in, where we're like, actually we're running a business and we should try and be creative with the way that we run this business as well.
Interesting mental shift.
Yeah, it's also that thing, I think, as well as like now that we have a better understanding of time, I think, you know, yeah, to even let that go and kind of be like, you know, we've been doing what we've been doing for such a long time that I don't necessarily think we need to be paid by the hour. I think it's kind of like if we can do something really quickly, but it's like that's taken us 10 years to figure out how to do that.
Yeah. So now we're sort of, it's about the value of our experience now. We're aware of time and how long things take us, but we don't charge based purely on that at all. It's really like, actually, what can we actually bring to this job that is not, you know, it can't be really measured in just time, obviously.
Completely. Value-based pricing. It's something we talk about a lot here on the show and at Jackie Winter in general. But I guess the difference still is that even if you're charging sort of value-based, it's still, I guess, dependent on the number of projects you might get a year, or, you know, compared to a consistent income. And like, has that, I know that things have shifted, you know, as you say, you've sort of shifted this mentality of like running a business and your careers have grown so much and changed so much and developed so much. But did you have these kinds of anxieties when you were earlier on in your careers?
We still have these anxieties, you know, and I think, you know, we've just moved countries as well. You know, like we still do lot of work for Australian clients, which has been great, but we're trying to establish ourselves in New York. And I think we got sort of used to, you know, we're quite comfortable in Australia because we felt more established, you know, whatever that means. And here we're like, you know, no one knows who we are, which is sort of really
it's a bigger pond.
Yeah, exactly. You know, which is really exciting, but also really scary at the same time. So these things are some things that we're constantly on our minds. You know, like I think this anxiety, I think because we had to learn to manage that anxiety in Australia anyway, in terms of never really knowing, I think that it sort of taught us how to live with that anxiety and sort of not let that sort of affect. You just have to have really strong nerves.
Completely.
Like, if you're doing everything that you need to be doing, you know that you're doing that. You sort of just have to sort of trust that things will come in, and we have strategies and things that we know that we can do in order to secure the sort of work that we want. But you still have to have. There's still a lot of like trust.
There's some faith.
Some there as well.
To your point and the article's point as well is sort of saying, you know, you can kind of sort of step back as well. And I mean, I actually really like your point about like, why is stepping back all about like being more productive? It doesn't. I mean, of course, it's about a balance, trying to have a balanced lifestyle. And, you know, if you're feeling good within yourself, yes, you will be more productive, but that is also a really good thing as well.
So, yeah.
I think that's
absolutely.
That management of the anxiety is, I think, a really big point, because especially here in New York, which is really crazy, sort of intense sort of city, like I think that's what we've
learned.
Yeah,
I hear it never sleeps.
It goes to sleep at 4.
we know.
Yeah, we've been there. But I think Melbourne's a city that never sleeps, actually. But I think that what we've had to learn to do even more so than in Melbourne was, you know, like Ed and I both do meditation. Like we both know that getting out of the city, like our friend Craig Redmond, who's been living here for quite a while, Craig and Carl, his advice to us when we first moved over was like, look, the city's amazing, but you just have to get out, you know? So like we go upstate as often as we can. We leave the country.
Isn't that a movie?
Get out. Yeah. So long as you can leave the city, you'll be fine. And I think just learning to take care of ourselves more, it's sort of more important here, like our mind, it helps us become more productive, obviously, but also just, you know, I think that when you take care of yourself, you're more creative, you know, and I think that's the most important part.
Completely. Now, Jeremy, I want to chat to you about maybe some of the more practical kind of points here, because I'd love to know like what in this article resonated with you as when you were freelancing and also as like a current as a business owner, and I guess some thoughts about what freelancers can do aside from getting a full-time job to kind of counteract this anxiety. Is it a privilege only for those who are successful?
What do you mean how is there the difference in your mind?
I mean, for people who know that work is just coming in constantly versus people who are actually kind of fighting a bit each day to get enough work, how can people manage this kind of tension?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question. So many things are coming up in this article. It's a short article and it's a really, really big topic because the foundations of our economy are really kind of shifting. I've been in both sides. I've been kind of a freelancer. I've also been a salaried employee. And I kind of feel that now I'm a business owner.
And sort of responsible for freelancers.
Exactly,
in a way.
Yep. As well. And I mean, I would just kind of say that the kind of stress that I feel now, I think, is so much more acute than when I was a freelancer or anything else. I mean, I think it's kind of like the whole idea is kind of freedom, you know? And I think that the reason people freelance is because they want to be, you know, they do value their own time. They want to be in kind of control of it a bit more. But then ironically, there's so much kind of pressure. It puts all these kind of constraints on you. And I feel the same kind of freelancing as I did now, but kind of, you know, now as I did freelancing, but just kind of times 100 kind of in a few different ways. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting thing from this article that I don't really understand is, you know, the author says in one paragraph, if valuing money over time is making us sad and paranoid, how do we stop? But it seems to me it's actually the inverse. I think everyone who is a freelancer actually values their time over the money, but it's the pressure to get that time, which is causing, I guess, a bit of the anxiety. But like, I don't actually think that people value money more. I think people actually are valuing time so much more. And if you look at all these kind of trend reports of what's happening kind of every year, of like, what is the ultimate sign of luxury? People say time, like, you know, that rich people have more kind of time. It's not about like, you know, the money kind of allows them to kind of have that kind of in that kind of way. I mean, one thing that I found interesting that Tim and Ed were talking about is obviously the whole value-based pricing model, which is something that we're kind of talking a lot about. And I kind of see one of the kind of big areas that we kind of find a lot of conflict there is that the people who are engaging practitioners who are value-based are typically salaried employees as well. Mm. And that seems to create a lot of kind of cultural kind of conflict when you're kind of trying to have these negotiations. And there's so much that you have to consider, especially when you're a freelancer, that people don't really kind of see. So it's like, you know,
that's very, very true.
And, you know, we're always kind of talking about the fact that when you're a freelancer or when you're a small business, you're running all the different kind of aspects of your business. And so, you know, being your own kind of accountant is a big part in that way, or kind of, you know, that the cost that they see, it's, you know, you get a kind of, salaried employees, they get kind of, I mean, it's different countries, all the different kind of deductions and those things work, but you have to kind of account for all those things. So you have to account for the fact that you might, you know, that you need to retire at some point, you know, and need to take care of that.
Sick leave or...
And that 30% of all your income in most places is going kind of straight to taxes. And that's a fact. There's a lot of instability in the life as a freelancer, and you have to account for that with profit margins and things like that. So the prices like are, you know, bloating bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think that is kind of hard when you put that in front of somebody and they don't kind of understand, like, well, how does this kind of relate to my world where I'm a salaried employer?
And I do 2 weeks of work and I get X amount.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is a project that's only going to take you a little bit, and it's costing all this, et cetera. So I think, you know, there's really kind of two parts that need to be kind of decoupled from this whole piece, which is this whole idea of kind of how we value our time, which is a big thing that I think a lot of people kind of are attacking. But then also like a bigger question about kind of what the purpose of work is, you know, and like why we kind of work and what we want to get out of work and what we kind of want to use our time for. And I think that's what's so nice about the creative industries is that, well, what I love about it is that I get to kind of do work that, you know, has some kind of meaning in the context of a capitalist society, but through a creative lens, which kind of, I guess, nourishes me a bit more kind of, you know, in that way. But it's a really, I think that's a huge privilege that we get to have that not everybody else kind of has, like kind of with their work. And I think now, because of everything that's happening kind of in society, like we're kind of questioning this, like, you know, why are we working? And, you know, what is it supposed to actually accomplish? And I think that will be the biggest disruptor for our industry as more people kind of start to question that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we sort of come back to at the end here is that in terms of like what people can actually do about these kinds of feelings and thoughts is that it's sort of twofold. There's the practical side of educating yourself on value-based pricing and being comfortable with selling that into clients and communicating your value. And then also the sort of emotional, psychological side of how you feel about your work and your time and finding a balance there, something that you can be comfortable with that works for you as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I disagree with the fact that if you're looking at your time like a, you know, like a running kind of meter, like that is not going to be healthy, because it's like you've paid for that time already, you know, like through, you know, through other things that you've kind of already done. So like, you know, you should be able to kind of enjoy that time just kind of as, you know, that's kind of the fruit of your labor kind of in that way, not kind of an opportunity cost. You know, it's tricky.
It's tricky. As always, we'll end it there.
Yes, a really good piece, and we will put the links to that in our show notes as always and move on from there. As it seems to happen every week, like, you know, all of our links are kind of somewhat, you know, we don't kind of talk about our links, you know, before we put them together. And like, I've always find that so interesting that there's kind of a running theme. And so we were talking a bit before about anxiety around kind of time and money. And I'm going to kind of make a bit of a jump here, kind of talk about anxiety specifically relating to marketing and promoting yourself as artist. So, I mean, with all the talk has been surrounding Facebook for years now, and the whole kind of way that the algorithm kind of runs our life, another topic we've talked about last week on the podcast. But yeah, it's easy to forget the other elephants in the room in terms of the products that Facebook owns, like things like WhatsApp, and especially one that's so close to the hearts of many of us in the design and illustration community, and that is, of course, Instagram. So a few months, we started doing something new. We posted these weekly roundups, not only of what we've been posting on Instagram, but kind of what our artists were posting on their own accounts as well. And we created a separate standalone Instagram account, which just followed our artists. And I started to notice something really strange in that, like, our artists weren't really posting their work that regularly. Like, I was looking for kind of 10 posts to put up every week, and I was finding them hard to find. So I found this really strange, because Instagram is one of the most powerful marketing platforms in the world right now, especially for people in the visual or creative fields. So I would have thought that everyone would have been leaping at the opportunity here. So when I actually started asking more of our artists about it, I was pretty surprised to hear that there was a lot of reluctance to participate. And people were saying there's such a high standard they have to meet, or they didn't feel like they had anything useful to post, or they didn't know kind of how to do it, or they, you know, they felt it was a bit of a chore. And I was really confounded by this. So at almost the same time that these conversations were happening, this link that I'm going to talk about started making the rounds. So I knew something was in the air and that it could be something timely kind of to discuss, because a lot of people were asking me about it and said, let's talk about it in the podcast. This link came up. It all kind of came together. So the title of the piece is We Need to Talk About Instagram, Illustration Agency Handsome Frank on Algorithm Anxiety. So this is coming from the Lecture in Progress site, which I think is a project of It's Nice That, or the kind of group that runs It's Nice That. We've linked and talked about them before. And this was written by John Cockley, one of the co-founders of Handsome Frank, off the back of a tweet that he wrote in January. And the post read simply, and I quote, "I know you all know this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The number of likes a piece of work gets on Instagram is in no way a reflection of how good it is. All caps, never stop doing what you do just because an algorithm doesn't appreciate it." And he goes on to say that, ironically, it was actually their most liked post. So that was funny. But for me, though, I found it really prescient that he was having the exact same experience as us in some ways. So with Instagram as a global platform, it's not surprising that two very different groups of artists coming from very different parts of the world can share in this kind of global anxiety that the platform has created. It's a hard thing to wrestle with, considering how many opportunities it's opened up at the same time. And John goes on to state that this was a prevailing theme that among their artists, they had this kind of annual in-person lunch. And he goes and says, conversations about likes, how to get them, how to increase followers, what content works best, seemed to be going on all around me. But the constant theme that everyone agreed on was ultimately how hollow the experience of posting work made them feel. Some conceded they'd more or less given up on posting work entirely. Now, remember, we're talking about very successful professional illustrators here. So if that's how it makes them feel, what hope is there for the next generation of artists? John goes on to make some pretty broad points about some better tactics to keep in mind when using the platform, also touching on the challenge that Instagram plays as a media platform where artists are being gauged for their follower accounts, and how brands are using micro-influencers more than traditional paid media platforms, as well as his own advice on how to make Instagram work for you and not against you. I'm not going to recap them all here. I think it's a really good piece. It's really short. It's worth reading. However, I thought I might just personally add my own two cents here to the conversation and open it up a bit more just to keep the momentum going on the conversation that John started. As he states himself in the piece as one of his kind of bits of advice, I quote, "Have a conversation about it, a real life one. Most people feel the same about Instagram, and hearing that people you know, respect, and admire also doubt their abilities will help you feel less alone." And to that end, so many of our artists have been asking me about the same thing. So I'll finally just echo one of John's last points, which he says, "Separate work and life. One reality that illustrators can't ignore is that clients are looking at Instagram. Profiles have essentially become an extension of our online portfolio." And for me, I think this is probably the most sound advice of the piece and one of the biggest takeaways. Every time I meet with a client, I always ask where and how they're discovering new talent. I've been consistently blown away at the creativity that people have used, both as artists in terms of how they get found, as well as clients in terms of how they're tracking and classifying the artists that they're finding. I found that clients who actually commission work as well, they rarely like work. And I'm one of these people as well. Like, I'm a scroller. I am not a liker. But I'm on Instagram hours a day, you know, for work in most cases. And I don't think people are deliberately lurking, but these are just super busy people. And usually they're adding work to collections or screenshotting. So this only further emphasizes John's point that, you know, the likes really don't have a lot of value. So look, a few months ago, we actually created our own separate Instafolio account. It's basically a scaled down mirror of our artist folios that could live on Instagram and on its own account. And it's been one of our most successful experiments to date. And I think that once you have that division of work and playing and have a standalone portfolio on Instagram, it creates a whole lot more mental space where the stakes just aren't that high. You don't really have to worry about, you know, if you just bombard that page with work, because it's not about followers or engagement. It's simply another place for your work to go. So to that end, my second piece of advice around Instagram is to actually find the next Instagram. So you guys saw that Instagram announced like a shopping feature last week. Mm-hmm. There's Instagram TV, sponsored post, non-chronological feed. It's become a really difficult place to be. And I think the original simplicity of just images in a chronological feed is what made Instagram such a popular home for artists, especially. And I think it's just what's going to drive us away into something new. I mean, it's not a radical thought. Like, every social media product since Friendster has kind of gone that way. But what you can do, however, is start to get into good habits now to be in the right place and the right time when this new platform arrives. So one thing we do here is we keep an editorial calendar. It's a great way to get yourself in that mode of discipline for regular posting, which I always advise our artists that they should be making a regular part of their practice. Again, just like we're talking before about, you have to be your own accountant, you have to be your own marketing department as well. And so if you don't do that, you avoid it at your own peril. I mean, one thing I always talk about is the portfolio is like a dartboard. Every piece that you add to your folio is another ring around that dartboard, a better chance of a client throwing that kind of, you know, I know you're laughing cliffhang, Lara, because you know another how much I love the metaphor.
Jeremy's favorite.
So if you can make this process as kind of seamless as possible, John mentioned apps like Buffer, but this actually doesn't actually post to Instagram because Instagram has a very restrictive API. So there's an app that's actually out of Melbourne called Sked Social, which we use, which is actually crazy. It's actually a warehouse filled with thousands of iPads and other devices that actually are just kind of, they've automated to post this content through their system. It's really cool. But look, once you have this ready, check out other platforms like Behance or even Elo, which is something that was a bit of a joke and a punchline for a while, but they've really pivoted to serve the creative market. And I think what's happening at the moment, the one thing missing from both these platforms is just a killer, simple mobile app that is fast. That's what Instagram did. But look how hard it is now to get actual design and behind the scenes content there. It's like all the hacks you have to do just to get things from the computer to the app. It's a bit crazy. So anyway, I know some of my suggestions here might actually create more anxiety for less technical minded people. And I totally understand that. And this is a really deep topic that we can only scratch the surface of. And I suppose for us, as well as agents, it's our job to find and do some of these things on behalf of our artists. But that's why I'm so excited to get some outside perspective here from our guests, especially Tin and Ed, because you have a really unique take on this as a duo. I mean, your names are your studio, Tin and Ed. You have a Tin and Ed Instagram account. You have a Tin and Ed account as well. So tell us a bit more. I'm really kind of curious, what role does Instagram play in your own practice from a marketing and promotional perspective?
It's really actually really important for us to get work, actually. Like quite a lot of creative people that we know, but we've always had a bit of a love, sort of hate relationship with it. I think like a lot of people, we sort of started using it because it was just so easy to use. And it was so easy just to get your work out there. And I think as it became more and more popular, I think there was a point, and even up until recently, where it sort of, we're a little bit crippled by this idea of engagement. And yeah, I don't know, like, I think it's really easy to freeze in terms of knowing when you still start to put too much importance on the engagement. And I think we're sort of at a point now where we actually sort of just don't take it too seriously. And we're just like, whatever, and sort of just play with it and really not look at the engagement. Because I agree with this article where if you sort of, if the value of it is on engagement, then it can be really creatively crippling. And it's actually not sort of useful for getting your work out there. And I think ultimately it's a really valuable tool to get your work out there in front of a very, very specific sort of audience, which is your platform, your audience that you've built, you know. And for us, it's like people who actually are commissioning work from us, as well as friends and, you know, people who will talk about our work, people in the media. It's a direct line to these people. And, you know, we don't have like huge amounts of followers, but it only needs to sort of land in the eyes of like the one person, you know, who's going to commission you that work. You don't have to have, you know, 50,000 people see it. You only need to have like 3 people see it, you know, if the right people see it, and that's all you need. So it's actually really, really, really valuable. But at the same time, we've had to shift our perspective on the way that we think about it in order to actually be able to engage with it. Otherwise it's...
I think for us, in terms of, you know, Tim's sort of talking about kind of chilling out about it a little bit, I think it was sort of reframing it as sort of a conversation and, you know, just having it really much more relaxed. And it is really interesting when you post things and different people relate to different conversations, just like normally when you're having a chat with someone, you know, people respond differently to different things. And kind of chilling out about it has definitely been really
good. I think that's a good way to put it. Like, we try and think about it as a way to have a conversation. And sometimes it's better to have a more sort of intimate conversation with someone who's engaging, you know, one person writing a comment, and then you start a conversation based on that. Then 50, you know, like heaps and heaps of people liking it, but then there's not really anything deeper than that. So yeah, I think it's a really good space to converse with people.
I think another aspect for us, and something that we've sort of talked about ourselves, is sort of this idea of playing in public. And, you know, we certainly post final work and do all that kind of stuff, but I think we really try to show our experiments and show our play and
our process.
Yeah, and our process sort of behind the scenes, all of that kind of stuff. Because it is really interesting, again, to see what people engage with and what that, you know, that might spark a conversation, you know, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a final piece. It can just be this little idea that you have. And
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So putting it out into the world and playing in public is, you know, I think there's inherently a fear with that it's like, you know, you're playing in public, but it's actually a really fantastic thing. So
I think and the only way to do that is really not to take it too seriously either, like like not putting that pressure on yourself.
And to do that,
but that's the thing with Instagram, right? Yeah. Like, things flow through the feed really quickly. It's not as permanent. Like, it should be a safe place to kind of play in public because it isn't so permanent. You know, it's just like scrolls through someone's feed. It's a much more like, I guess, current snapshot of what's happening, but it flies on by and then it's, you know, there's a whole lot of other stuff on someone's feed. It's not just like, that's not like a permanent thing that's sitting in your folio, you know?
Yeah.
It is. But I think what makes it feel permanent is how many people like it. And that's like, you know, like, and that sort of is what is, I think there's a problem with it. I don't know how you would fix that. Like, I mean, maybe it's based on how many people see. I don't know, actually. I don't know any sort of, actually I'm not sure how you'd fix that.
We saw a great talk probably about a year ago now by Zach Lieberman, who he's sort of like a creative coder. He does really interesting kind of work. And he, part of his talk was talking about, because he's very prolific.
On Instagram.
And he was talking about, essentially he posts every day or multiple times. But for him, it is, he's essentially got this folder on his computer, which is just called Every Day. And he just takes screen grabs and screen recordings and just really kind of catches everything. And he's really, really free with what he puts up.
I think that's a great idea, though, of having a folder that you just throughout the day as you're working. Because the other thing as well is actually just the amount of time it takes to do these things is hard. Like, and I know this from having, you know, over periods of time run our Jackie Winter socials, and like trying to fit that into the day is just like, it's a pain in the ass, you know? Totally. So like, you know, on the one hand, I'm the agent sort of telling my artists like, you know, be more active on Instagram, be more active. And then I'm also, when it comes to me doing it, I'm like, oh, fuck that. So the idea of having just this folder where you're just like constantly throwing stuff throughout the day and then to be able to quickly schedule it out through something like what Jeremy mentioned.
Yeah, which can be a little bit tricky. I mean, if you're working on stuff that you can't show.
Definitely.
Yeah. And
kind of tricky.
And I think that's the other thing too, is that there's this idea that, you know, what you're posting is what's happening in that moment. But like with our work, a lot of the projects that we work on, we're working on, you know, if they're installation based, we're working on for months and months and months, you know, even longer. We can't post any of it until it's, you know, been announced, it's out or whatever, but we still want to involve people in the process. So it's never really in real time. But there are things that you can still do in real time. Like Zach Lieberman, for example, his motto is always be iterating. And, you know, his work is this constant sort of evolution where it's sort of iterating and iterating. And he just puts all of that up. He's like, I don't think about it. If I think about it, I won't post it, you know. And I think that that's, and you can see it on his, I mean, his work's incredible. You know, he's a creative coder. He does a lot of this AR sort of, he uses, you know, coding to create incredible sort of visual sort of animations and things that sort of interact with, you know, spatially. It's better for some mediums than others, I think. But I think that's where it's, you know, I think if you overthink it, then that's when it just becomes really hard. I think that you sort of almost need to switch off your thinking brain a little bit and just do it and just put it up. And I think that, you know, and then once it flows, then it can sort of come out. But if you haven't posted in a while, it's really hard to do that next post because you're like, fuck, what, you know, it's, you know, if people won't like it, you know, if you're posting quite often, then it just come, you know, it's like turning on a tap. So
it's so hard to find that balance. I find when people post too much, though, then like that's when I start muting.
Well, one thing I have to say, and sorry, Mum, if you're listening to this, but Mum cannot wrap her head around how Instagram works, and so she forgets it exists, and then she logs in like maybe every 3 months, 4 months, and then we'll post like 80 photos in a row, and it like I don't think she realizes that it like. That fills someone's feed. And it's,
I sympathize with your mom. I don't know how Twitter works. Did you see, I tried to do something on Twitter the other week and ended up like writing like 80 tweets, like to like the wrong.
That's how Twitter works. Yeah. That is how Twitter works.
Laura, I want to hear a bit more from you. I mean, how do you think artists can make the most of Instagram for commercial purposes? Like any do's or don'ts that you see? I mean, you follow a lot of artists. You're always discovering new artists as well and kind of bringing them in. I'm just kind of wondering, what kind of advice you would have?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, Instagram is in my top sort of three ways that I find new artists, without a doubt, probably the number one. So as someone who, I mean, I'm not a commissioner, but I could be, do you know what I mean? I would be in that same space. And this article really struck a chord with me. I think one thing that John writes that really reflects my experience here at Jackie Winter, and you know, in many ways, we're very similar companies, of course, to, you know, Handsome Frank and Jackie Winter. And he says that through our experience of regularly posting work by a range of different artists and in varying styles, it quickly becomes apparent that some posts get better levels of engagement than others. To be clear, what we're talking about here is likes and comments, the currency of Instagram, but it is not a level playing field. The dice are loaded. coded. The site is engineered in order to reward, to rank and push some posts more while holding others back. What also became clear to us is that the popularity of a post has no direct bearing on the effectiveness or originality of the artwork. Some things work better than others with this audience. Generally speaking, we find that the more trend-driven, youth-oriented and colourful imagery tends to be more popular. Less credence, it seems, is given to the craft or concept behind an image, which might be down to the fact that it's harder to convey these things on a small screen. And that's, I mean, I find that absolutely true, but I think that the key thing here that he's getting at and that we've been trying to get at is that just because those other things don't necessarily generate likes from the masses, it doesn't mean that they're not valuable things to be posting, because the people that are looking for that stuff, which is whatever that client might be or that particular fan or whatever, will like it. Do you know what I mean? And it's quality over quantity, right? But I guess the tricky thing though, of course, is that it's, you know, it's kind of undeniable that if you are a commercial artist, many clients, not all, but many, are looking to commission things that will get engagement on their socials, because that's where the work is ultimately going, right? Like, it's not the case for all commissions, of course, but socials do play a huge role in any brand's media space these days. And so an artist's ability to generate content that gets likes is something that some clients are looking at. But I mean, you know, that said, I still definitely agree with what John says here, which is that it's, you know, it's not healthy to feed the feed. In his words, he says, stop trying to please the algorithm, make art for art's sake, make art for people, but don't chase the likes. One of the most worrying side effects of Instagram would be if artists change the way they work in order to try and increase Insta popularity. This would be a huge mistake. Stick to what you do and keep doing what makes you unique. Remember, you want to stand out, not fit in. And I think the reason this is important is not just because, like, you know, it's healthy and like there's all the, you know, lovely be yourself, kumbaya, you know, in there, but also trends come and go real fucking fast. Like, basing your career on following trends is not sustainable or anything that I would advise. And pushing your creative output into new space for the sake of your own artistic evolution is the only path, I think, to lasting success. Or at least that's what I believe based on what I'm sort of privy to every day as an agent. You know, it's not just that it's not like healthy to chase that stuff, but also it's not really necessarily a good model. Like, you might get lots of likes from random fans out there in the Instagram universe, but that's not necessarily the people who are looking to commission work. So it's not really relevant. And the people who are looking to commission work are wanting to see new sort of interesting things from artists that are experimenting and toying with stuff. So I guess, what does that then mean for like how someone should actually make use of their Instagram? Well, I think, like, firstly, I do think that for a commercial artist, at least being on Instagram is crucial. We know from firsthand experience that it is absolutely the first place that many clients are looking to find talent. So not being visible there is missing out on a key advantage, but it is a supplementary tool and it shouldn't take over your life. I think the point of Instagram is to be posting work that interests you and that you would like to do more of. Like, for me, an artist's website folio is that sort of like curated overview of their best work over time. And then their Instagram is a more current look at who they are, what they're experimenting with, how they're pushing their personal work and what their most sort of recent commercial projects are that they're proud of. And it's about like seeing what that artist is into today or this week or this month, you know, and getting some insight into their process and their personality. And it doesn't, as you guys were saying, Tin and Ed, like, it doesn't all need to be finished work. It can be sketches or whips or just like rough experiments. That's what excites me. Like, seeing an artist's own excitement about their work is what excites me. And I think if you're sharing things that you are genuinely excited about and interested in, then that's the right path.
Interesting. I mean, I think that, yeah, like I would say I have a bit of a different opinion in kind of some ways in terms of, you know, how work is kind of presented. And I think it's going to be different for every artist as well. And yeah, and I've always found it really interesting as well, like following Tin and Ed both personally, as well as kind of their, you know, their studio account, like, you know, where kind of those overlaps are and getting that kind of picture. But it is a different thing for every single person. Laura, sorry.
One thing I wanted to add is that he does mention in the piece, which I think is really valid. He writes that, like, as agents and clients, we also have a role to play. And like, one trend that concerns him is this sort of increase in clients getting in touch to request illustrators with a big social following and the issues that raises. And that's something we've talked about here, like, internally many times, because, like, firstly, there's that implication that the client or the agency is more interested in the follower numbers than the work, which is troubling for, you know, its own reasons. And I guess what John says he explains to clients and what we have many times as well is that you're always better off picking the artist that is best suited to the brief rather than the one that's most popular on Instagram, like, every single time, without a doubt. And then secondly, there's also this implication here that the illustrator's audience is available for purchase, which is definitely not always the case. What he says and what I absolutely will echo is that most, if like not all of, you know, artists will not contractually agree to posting work on their Instagram feeds. If they like the project and they're really happy with the finished work, then yeah, in all likelihood, they probably will share the work. But most don't actually sell their audience or like access to the audience. And if they do decide to do so, it's definitely not for free, right? Like, I guess if you're choosing an artist on the strength of their audience, you're essentially trying to buy two things for the, you know, two different things for the price of one, as John says. You know, you're trying to buy the creative and the media in the one thing. His advice and my advice as well to any illustrator that is going to be sort of selling that audience, you know, don't do it for free. That's a huge point of value in its own right.
Well, yes. Thank you for the input, Laura. Much respect to everyone at Handsome Frank and John, especially for bringing this up. He's always got some fantastic content on Instagram and Twitter that they post. So yeah, looking forward to keeping that conversation going and we'll move on from there. Our final link from the week is another piece from the AIGA blog. It's something that's been coming up a lot recently and also kind of on an interesting subject that might kind of on the surface seem a bit more, I guess, inside baseball, but it has more kind of application than meets the eye, which is variable typography, something we spoke about with Reese from TCYK. Tin and Ed, you bring us this link this week. It's so interesting because, I want to kind of dig into this a bit more, especially around, you know, the recent project you've been working on with dance and performance and the fact that this is a project that launched at Design Indaba, which you were at recently as well to launch a similar project. I'm wondering about that kind of serendipity there. But before we get into all those exciting things, something I ask all of our guests every week, tell us a bit more about your internet hygiene. Where do you kind of find links? How do you kind of let things kind of filter through? Tell us everything.
I think it's better at this than me, so I'm going to hand this.
Yeah, I mean, go down the rabbit hole, really, kind of literally kind of everything. And certainly Instagram's a really nice way to sort of start off, and then kind of following sort of what people are sort of talking about on Instagram, and then kind of trying to do a little bit of a deep dive on some of those things if I kind of find it really interesting. So
I think we're like a lot more focused now in terms of what we're sort of reading, and that's more like because we're sort of really interested in some of these sort of new technologies that are happening now, and so we sort of tend to search specifically for them. Like I wouldn't say that we have any sort of feeds that we sort of just sort of scan through. I mean, I do love, you know, a lot of these sites like Iron Design, and it's nice that for some more general sort of ideas of what's happening out there in the design community. But I mean, I think where we love to listen to podcasts about, you know, like space and, you know, new science discoveries and all this sort of stuff. I think that's probably a bit more interesting to us generally, because this is sort of where our ideas are sort of being drawn from and sort of our research.
Yeah, I think we get influenced by literally everything. And, you know, some nature podcast might really spawn an idea. And for us, it all comes back to sort of what we're trying to communicate and how we're trying to communicate that. And, you know, if there's a little seed, in a nature podcast of an idea, you know, it can be really, you know, can just sort of set something up in a kind of interesting way for us.
Well, yeah, I mean, something I've always noticed about you and something I've always admired is, I mean, I don't say this in a pejorative way, but you've always known what's kind of cool. I've always thought you're much cooler than anyone else I know. But also the way that you use your kind of community of kind of friends and colleagues as well, like as part of kind of your practice, it's a very kind of interpersonal thing. And like, I've always admired that as well. So, I mean, that's kind of why I'm really especially interested in kind of in this project, in this link. I've already preceded it a bit too much. So why don't you tell us a bit more about what this link is particular and why you chose it and yeah, how it's relating to your practice at the moment.
Yeah, so this link is from Ion Design, and it's written by Madeline Morley, who we actually got to meet in Cape Town. And it's about a project which they launched there as well, which is a project done by NM Type, who are a two-person type design studio that are split between Spain and Sweden. And they collaborated with a dancer, Adal Vallum, who's based in Cape Town. And I think we're really interested in this project, not so much for the typographic sort of side of it, because we don't actually design typefaces ourselves, in the fact that they sort of use technology, that they're working across three different countries, that it's a very interesting sort of combination or collaboration, where it's sort of an unusual sort of collaboration between a type designer and a dancer. And this idea of, you know, design as performance is something that actually came up a bit in Design Indaba, which is a design conference conference, but they have lots of different speakers. And this medium of dance came up quite a lot. Wade and Lita, who are other sort of New York sort of graphic designers, they sort of talked about designers' performance. I think there were three or four other sort of people where it sort of came up. There was some cyborg artist and Moon Ribas. She did a dance performance where she sort of danced to the earthquakes that she could actually sense in her feet using a seismic sort of implant. So dance sort of came up quite a lot in this design indaba. I don't know if that's a normal thing, but the idea of performance and live, creating work that is has some sort of live sort of input or live sort of experience with is something that's really interesting to us right now. And it was really great to see that it was coming up quite a lot in other people exploring these sort of creative, different creative mediums as well.
Sounds like a fascinating conference.
Yeah, no, it was actually...
It's really, really amazing.
It was incredible.
I think because it's really bringing together, well, as Tim was sort of saying, lots of diverse practices and lots of diverse ways of thinking and cultures, and it's a really great sort of mixing pot of
Because they've had chefs and, you know, musicians, and, you know, they have people working in technology. It's such a mix of people, and I think that's the most interesting thing to us is actually how do we sort of break down these borders, these boundaries between these different disciplines, and how do people sort of start to interact between these, because that's when some really interesting things can come about.
I completely agree. I mean, it's something we talk about a lot, that the idea of sort of borrowing from other industries and like applying different practices to your own to see how you can sort of, I don't know, generate something completely, completely new. I even like, I spoke at Paws Fest recently here in Melbourne, and one of the things I really enjoyed.
Sorry, every time I hear you talking about that, I just think it's a festival for pets. And I just
like, fucking wish it was a festival for pets.
Little paws.
How goddamn good would that be? Oh my God, I would definitely speak of that. If anyone does that, please invite me to speak. But no, I spoke there recently, and that was something I loved as well, was this like, it's rare that I get to go to a conference that isn't like all designers or all something, you know, like this was
AG people. Ideas was like that when it was here. Were you around when that was around?
I also spoke earlier at that, but I don't even remember anything. I didn't really get to see much else. But this was great because I loved that you had people from like, I don't know, people who were working in like the Large Hadron Collider and from NASA and stuff. And then you also had people who were like, I don't know, working in like food and then like biology. And then you had people like me who were illustration agents, and it was just like such a mixing pot. But yeah, I'd love to hear more, I guess, about how you guys are kind of using this sort of industry collaboration, sort of these ideas in your own practice.
I'm specifically curious in how it relates to kind of, the project that you're working on at the moment. I'd love to hear more about it because I've only kind of seen it from the sidelines.
Yeah, I mean, this project that we're working on, which is called We Come in Peace, it's continually in development because we did launch it at Design Indaba, which was really exciting. I mean, like really, like it existed as a live projection piece at Design Indaba, but it's using a games engine called Unity. So we can actually present it in many different ways as a virtual reality experience, as an AR experience, as, you know, multi-channel sort of screen.
Multi-screen
experience. Yeah. But in Cape Town, in its first sort of iteration, it was a projection, and we've just sort of been traveling quite a bit. So we've been using 3D scanning a whole bunch of people that we've met, you know, friends, artists, designers from around the world, collecting their data. We actually have quite a lot of people. It takes quite a long time to process them, but we've been re-sculpting them into like these new sort of species, creating avatars for them, I guess, and then putting them into this games engine, which is the great thing about working in a games engine, is that it's not pre-rendered. It's actually a live environment.
It's all real time.
It's all real time. So we've been training these avatars to dance. And so it's like a virtual dance party. But we, you know, at the moment, we're sort of trying to sort of figure out ways to make it more interactive. So because it's a live environment, there's this opportunity that we can sort of actually develop AI, artificial intelligence, for these avatars so they can behave in different ways depending on, you know, like an auto input, like a live DJ, or visual input, or even sort of data sets. Like we can sort of feed in data information, and then that can affect the way that these avatars dance or behave. So we're sort of essentially creating a little universe using this games engine. And then also we love working with other people and bringing our community and the people that we meet into our work. So, you know, there's all sorts of people who we've met, interesting creative people who are actually becoming part of this project as well.
So it's mind-blowing. I love this project. And I we'll absolutely include some links to some of the stuff that you're doing here with the show notes, because I think like we can sort of talk about it all we want, but I think people really need to see it to really to grasp how awesome this concept is. So we'll, you know, anyone listening, please do go have a look.
Thank you. Cool. Yeah, no, we're really excited by it because it sort of just brings together a lot of things that we're really interested in sort of technology, community, bringing people together, finding ways that we can actually come together in a united sort of space, even if it's a virtual sort of space, using, you know, a games engine, which is usually used for violent games where you kill each other and shoot each other, to actually create a space where you have a different type of experience. And then, yeah, just there's just lots of things about it that we're that really excite us.
And also kind of sort of bouncing between, you know, the real world and the digital world and then back out again and yeah. back into it. And that's part of sort of how we live our lives anyway at the moment is really yeah, sort of absolutely. Like in the digital world and then back in our yeah. own world. And I think we're sort of trying to think about what are some really sort of positive experiences you can kind of have when you combine that kind of
process. Yeah, that blurring the boundaries between the physical Completely. And digital sort of worlds. Yeah. yeah.
And that's going to be a subject matter, I think, that we're all kind of battling, might not be the right word, but I guess considering over the next however many years, you know, as that becomes a more evident, I guess, part of our lives. One thing you guys noted that you wanted to chat about was like how this development of new technology allows artists, designers, et cetera, to sort of create work that is more generative, adaptive, fluid, and how that sort of is potentially affecting the world of illustration and stuff as well. And I mean, this project is such a good example of how sort of these, you know, technologies, you talk about this games engine and sort of scanning and stuff has allowed you to create this really sort of, I guess, yeah, interactive involving piece. And I'd love to open that up, you know, more about whether that's changing sort of illustration as well. Jeremy, did you have any thoughts here?
Well, I mean, I was really interested to hear that they were exploring Unity to do this. Mm. I mean, and that's kind of, Unity is such an interesting platform. And one thing I've always admired from your practice, again, is kind of how you've explored kind of motion graphics and other kind of things before they kind of reach a tipping point in this way. Like you've always kind of been, you know, been pushing the bounds of what this can do. And, you know, we've been like, I had a firsthand look of kind of how to work in Unity through the VR app that we'll probably have launched by the time we kind of talk about this. But yeah, just kind of putting work kind of in this kind of different context, because the way that the work is kind of meaning our lives is kind of so different as well. So yeah, like that was I thought was really interesting for sure.
Yeah, I think like as we can see with this piece, going back to just the type thing again, the NM piece, like the technological advances of variable type have sort of allowed NM to explore movement in this really sort of unique, flexible, adaptive way that wasn't possible once upon a time. You know, like I mean, they could have just created a range of static styles that sort of showed these different concepts, but that adjustable nature of variable type really lends itself perfectly to a font inspired by dance and body movement. And I think similarly, like tech advances, affecting all areas of art and design. For example, I guess one thing that often comes up here, I think we mentioned on the show recently, or conversation we had the other day, Jeremy, I don't know, is that like as 3D software becomes cheaper, simpler, faster, and just generally sort of more democratized, that we're seeing so much more work in that 3D space from illustrators everywhere. And it's not just that this style is trendy, which it certainly is at the moment, but it's also that it's just something that was previously only accessible to the very tech savvy. And that's sort of changing as the technology progresses. And I think this is like a weird thing to kind of bring up, but it reminds me like weirdly of when MySpace basically created this like strange new avenue for like millions of like teenage girls like myself to learn like basic coding. Like, do you remember that? MySpace.
I remember that.
Completely. Like, and before that, I mean, my dad's a developer and he tried to sort of get me into coding when I was like little and I just like didn't care. And then like MySpace came up and through that, I had like all these new ways to kind of express myself through HTML and CSS, which sounds like, I know it sounds insane. And like, I mostly used it to put like weird like glitter emojis everywhere. But I think there's like similarities there in that like when technology becomes sort of democratized in a way and like accessible and simplified enough for people to start making use of it, artists are always some of the first to latch on and to sort of really explore new ways of bending that and shaping that into things that are really exciting. Yeah. And, you know, we talked about that a lot as well when we were talking about AI art and VR art and all sorts of things that we've discussed on the show and like how artists are always, well, often one of the sort of key groups that are pushing these technologies forward in really, really interesting ways. It's not just the tech people or the science people. It's seeing what artists are doing with these things.
And the porn industry.
And the porn industry. Exactly. You know what? Next episode, we'll do a deep dive into the porn industry. Sounds good. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating.
I'm curious. Did you know that this was going to be launched at the same time that you were going to be kind of doing your thing? Was that just kind of a coincidence?
No, it was a coincidence. But as I mentioned, actually, there were actually quite a lot of projects that were presented or were talked about within people's talks that had that related to dance. And I think, you know, I think one of the things that actually was, you know, maybe the bigger picture of it was that as technology is sort of changing, the mediums and the platforms that we're sort of showing work in are sort of for sort of more live, sort of more conducive to showing work, which is live, I guess. And I think that maybe that sort of allows for projects which are more sort of performative, which have a live sort of element to it. I'm not sure. Like, I mean, that's sort of what we can sort of see for us, you know, the future for us is creating work in these sort of live sort of platforms, because it allows for interactivity and it allows for sort of adaptive, sort of fluid, reactive sort of.
No, I agree. I think that's also, I see that as a bit of a rebound as well from, like, you know, everyone has sort of become more and more dispersed because of sort of like our lives moving online, right? Mm. And then you have these like rebound movements of people wanting to come back into a space together and back into sort of real interactivity that, in a way, as you said, kind of combines that digital, the benefits of digital, but with actual physical, real life, you know, person to person experiences. And we're seeing so much of this kind of like, we've been running so fast towards this wall and now we've smacked into it and we're kind of rebounding back, and people are wanting to sort of realizing what we're missing by having these like really real sort of in-person interactions.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because, yeah, they talk about VR as well. When we've talked about it being kind of this empathy machine and kind of putting you in that kind of spot is going to be, I think, where, you know, a lot of our expression is going to be going. But also at the same time, like, performance in design is nothing super new. I mean, you look at kind of what Stefan Sagmeister was doing, like, you know, using his body kind of in that way. I'm curious, I mean, to kind of round things out, are there any other kind of projects or practitioners that you can perhaps open our audience up to that's doing kind of work in this space that you're kind of tuned into?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, our friends Lita and Wade, who are graphic designers in New York, they're a couple. I mean, they're married, and they also spoke at Design Indaba. Wade's actually Australian, and he used to work for Sagmeister, in fact. But their work is very performative as well, and they talked about designers' performance in their work too, where, you know, they actually had dancers dressed up, just dancing around them, you know, doing funny things while they were speaking. But I think that there is, you're right, it's not a new thing, but I think that it's sort of, we've seen more and more of it, you know, over the years, I guess.
I think sort of new technologies do open up new ways of communicating, and, you know, there's kind of sort of, you're able to sort of experiment with that in with new kind of ways. But fundamentally, I think obviously the point is, like, what is the story? Like, does, you know, it's not about playing around with technology for technology's sake. It's like, does this technology allow you to actually have a new conversation or talk about things or give a different perspective or whatever that is?
And I think that technology right now is opening up this idea of space, you know, not just 3D, but like this idea of spatial sort of interaction. And maybe that's what this dance and performance sort of really lends itself to, is that, you know, dance is a medium that sort of really makes most of a space as well. And I don't know, like 3D technology is becoming more accessible. 3D scanning is really, you know, we bought one super cheap. They're, you know, this technology is going to be on everyone's phones very soon.
You can go to Officeworks and like get a full body scan done of yourself, which totally. We actually did once.
Absolutely, yeah. So, that's good to know. So all this technology is, I think, like with 3D scanning, for example, it's sort of like when photography, you know, was not this big sort of camera that had to be in a room, and it sort of became small enough to actually take around, and what people captured completely changed, and what the way that we see the world completely changes then as well. And I think with 3D scanning, it's the same thing. You know, you're not scanning, you know, when that was expensive and not portable, you're scanning very specific things, but now you can just take it around, you know, scanning rubbish on the street or whatever. So I think it's allowing us to see and access the world in a completely different way, and then represent it in a way which is more true to its real form, which is three-dimensional. So it's an interesting sort of space, you know, that's sort of probably why we're sort of interested in exploring that. And then movement and motion is almost another dimension in itself as well. So yeah, it's I think watch this space. I think more and more people will be working in it, I think.
Absolutely. Well, look, thanks for bringing it to our attention. It's some great stuff in there. I mean, yeah, how motion is being and change is being, I guess, implemented into all of our tools is really exciting. So yeah, we look forward to seeing how you guys take it in the future. So thank you so much. It is time for the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the completely... Give me a word, Lara.
My brain stopped.
And the completely my brain stopped off our guest. Lara, what do you got for us this week?
I had one, but I'm throwing it out. I'm changing it to a thumbs down to how difficult it is to communicate with you during the podcast when you're like, we don't want to make sound, and I'm trying to do like weird baseball style hand gestures at you to like communicate different things about the show. And right now I was trying to tell you off for picking up a crumpled piece of paper that was picking up on the mic.
It was calling to me.
And the only way I could do it was by like fake slapping my hand as though like, you know, like someone goes to like steal some of your chips and you like slap their hand away. That's I was like doing it, Jeremy. And anyway, it's very weird. And I think one day we should probably do like a film of like what we look like while we're shooting, because there's lots of weird gestures.
We can do our own motion captures here.
Exactly.
For us.
That's my thumbs down. What about you, Jeremy?
I don't know. It's a bit of a shaka, but I'm going gray. Have you noticed this?
I found a white hair in my own head, Jeremy.
Okay. Well, this is a crazy thing. This is kind of like, I have this thing, this may be a bit TMI for the podcast, but I have this thing called the brain hair, which is like in the middle of my forehead, a really, really, a single white hair grows like over the course of like months.
Is it called a brain hair?
I call it my brain hair. Like, cause I think it means it's like kind of
where from your brain.
Coming from my brain. And it gets really, really...
Is this a thumbs up, right?
this is a shaka. It's like, it kind of goes into both territories. Anyway,
I've never seen your brain hair.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's why I only catch it every couple of months. You have to kind of catch the light a bit away. Hopefully, I try to catch it early. But
and
anyway,
then you like pluck it out?
Yeah, I plucked it out. Anyway, this wasn't about my brain hair. This is more about me just going gray in kind of general. And I don't know how I feel about it.
And no, I haven't noticed as well. But I think you can age gracefully, Jeremy. It's time for you to go gray. You're at that point in your life.
I'm dying. That's what it means.
I'm saying it's time for you to shut down and accept that. But I am in my prime, Jeremy. I'm in my mid-20s. And I found a fully white hair on my head. And I was fucking devastated. Anyway, Tin and Ed, what about you guys? Tin, let's start with you. What have
we
you got?
We also have white hair as well, so
we can start a club.
I feel like they all came out about the same time when I moved to New York. So I don't know. I'm going to thumbs down because this happens to me all the time, and I live in Chinatown, and there's so much spitting that happens by everyone, not just the Chinese community. Just everybody is just spitting everywhere all the time. So that's my thumbs down.
I think that's a very fair thumbs down. Ed, what about you? Can you bring us up?
Yeah, I'm going to bring it up. So thumbs up. Tin and I the other day went and selected out colored pencils, and it was I was amazed at how excited I got by choosing the most perfect color combinations, and we did some stuff with it, and it was just really great. So,
yeah, that's really nice.
That's a nice one.
Wholesome.
Oh, I just remember how excited I used to get going, like my parents would take me to Officeworks or something to pick out gel pens.
Oh my God,
that's
so
how
excited.
I feel.
Oh,
yeah.
I love gel pens.
Well, guys, thank you again so much. If people want to find out more about you, more about your projects, where can that happen?
Probably on our Instagram, because we don't update our website often enough. Tin and Ed, so TINANDED.
Fantastic.
I have to say, your website, though, is one of my favorite like folio presentations of artist colleagues. I really love it. It's such a good website.
That up today.
Yeah, no. But it's developed by PDA, who I know that you work with as well, and they're awesome.
Yes, no. PDA. Guys, thank you again so much for being so generous with your time, and we will keep in touch. Talk soon.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. And if you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and links we've covered can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Or if you prefer, you can receive all the links we talk about each week in one neat little package along with everything else Jackie Winter over at our newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, you can sign up at jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly again on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, or Apple Podcasts, you'll be able to see links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content. And finally, if you work for an ad agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye. As well as being two of our very favorite people, Tin and Ed are creative directors and artists working between Melbourne and New... Oh, sorry, I'm going to start that over. As well as being two... As well as...
No, I think we got it.